This is Emily with your Politics in Action report at your local radio station, CJMQ 88.9 FM, bringing you your local, provincial, and federal political news. In local news, the Bishop's Art Gallery is exhibiting a What Were You Wearing exhibit. The exhibit was organized by Bishop's Sexual Health Coordinator, Catherine Heber-Mitte, and is purposed to denounce the stigma that rape survivors were wearing provocative clothes that prompted sexual assault. This often comes from investigators and court judges making the assumption survivors of sexual assault were asking for the attack based on what they were wearing. Victim blaming is one of the themes of this exhibit and is what gave rise to the Me Too movement. Quebec universities are increasingly making headlines corresponding to universities responding to sexual assault cases. For instance, an anonymous student is filing a lawsuit against Concordia University for its mishandling of her claim of being sexually harassed by a philosophy professor. The former philosophy student states she made a claim back in 2009, which was not seen through in seriousness by school officials. In later years, when the student was still seeking to file complaints, she had learned that other female students harassed by the same professor were permitted to take the class with a different professor. As this case exemplifies, survivors of sexual assault are often also victims of the lack of a developed framework to handle sexual assault cases. Without a framework, there is no standard way of processing complaints, and depending on the officials on staff, one way of processing would differ from another's. By establishing a formal framework, it becomes easier to process and handle cases of sexual assault. As well, students at the Université de Montréal made headlines this week following 300 students standing by the fact that the process of filing a sexual assault complaint is flawed. The process is flawed given how it is lengthy, and when testifying in front of a disciplinary committee, the perpetrator is allowed to be present. In other words, there are no safeguards for the survivor, and the current framework favors the perpetrator, which is unacceptable given the survivor is the one going through emotional turmoil and is ultimately traumatized. If there are any safeguards, it should be provided for the survivor, as they are the party that is hurt. The reality is, nobody asks to be violated, and they often associate with people they trust or are trusted. The fact of the matter is, it shouldn't matter what you wear, because without any consent, there's nothing to be done. It's like entering into a contract. You agree to the terms and conditions, and if something is done outside the terms of the contract, then that is a violation of the contract. It's the same idea. You cannot do things that are not specified in agreement. Otherwise, damages ensue, more so in the case of sexual assault. The Bishop's exhibit will be open until this Friday and is open to the public. Upon visiting, it is extremely moving. You pick up the emotions of each story. And it is a manner for people who don't really understand sexual assault, having not experienced it, to grasp some sentiments of survivors. What you realize attending this exhibit is that there are so many, and this is a heartbreaking fact. Current statistics of sexual assault demonstrate the amount of instances, but this is somewhat flawed given that most cases of sexual assault go unreported. The more we can inform of this issue, the more we can hope for informing people that this is a serious issue. Because in reality, we cannot really stop sexual assaults from occurring. The only thing we can do as friends, family members, and colleagues is inform others and help by being an active bystander when we can. Montreal suburb may be the first location in Canada to adopt a bylaw that prohibits smoking in public places. The legislation was passed Monday by a vote of 5 in favor and 2 in opposition. The bylaw strictly prohibits tobacco and marijuana to be consumed in public disciplines, including sidewalks and streets. Fines for the first-time offense would range anywhere between $100 to $300 and $600 for second offenses. This legislation is a way of systematically moving away from tolerating smoking, which tells us that the government is attempting to discourage people from the habit. What we have here is the incidence of the effects of municipalities preparing to control and regulate the marijuana substance as it enters Canadian society. One of the biggest concerns of legalizing marijuana is the ability to control and maintain the substance, so it does not get out of hand and is not everywhere in the public setting. This was the incentive for the municipality of Hampstead, as it did not want the burden of smelling the substance in public settings. This is the community's way of combating the marijuana legislation. As we know, most communities are reluctant to see this legislation to become law. The current status of the marijuana legislation is that it is circulating in the Senate for its second reading, which means the legislation will not pass by July 1st as initially planned, as it has become a process of progressing and stalling. All in all, what needs to be understood is that legalizing marijuana legislation won't be solely a federal responsibility. In fact, it will impact all levels of government, including provincial and municipal. So governments need to act in any way they can to prepare to deal with marijuana once it is legalized, which includes probably one of the most important aspects, setting up boundaries where it can and cannot be consumed. Service Canada is moving away from addressing anyone as Mr., Mrs., and Miss. Instead, Service Canada is looking to address people in a more gender-neutral format. For example, naming parent opposed to gender-specific terms as mother and father, and instead of using Mr., Mrs., and Miss, service workers are required to address a person by their name or ask them how they prefer to be addressed. As well, Canadian citizens are able to identify as gender X on their passports. This process, while it seems simple enough, is a difficult process. Canadians are getting confused when service officials ask what is the name of parent number one, in other words, whose name first appears in matter concerning a child. As well, this initiative does not come without opposition. Conservative MP Gerald Deltel critiqued that one day the government will rid of Mother's and Father's Day. We often face difficulties associated with this in our daily lives, so sometimes we don't know how to pronounce someone's name or whether they identify as a certain identity. This is why more and more public areas are removing signage from public washrooms so as to not seclude the washroom to one gender. And this is another way of not trying not to offend people. And yes, we are developing into a society where we want to increasingly be sensitive to other people's feelings. And this is an attempt to be more inclusive to society. It's actually one of the government's initiatives. The federal government is focusing a great deal on gender equality, as well as neutrality, a major investment in its federal budget. So it's to be expected that there will be a lot of changes associated with gender neutrality. There was the incident of the gender-neutral national anthem, and we can expect more to come. It appears the threat of fake news and the threat of foreign hacking is rendering the government to take extra precautions in preventing interference into the next federal election. Research has demonstrated that Canadians lack in trust towards any form of social media and governmental institutions, and they have every reason to do so, and here is why. There is an increasing risk for Western countries to endure a cyber attack. According to statistics provided by Treasury Board President Scott Bryson, an estimated 13% of elections globally saw some form of foreign interference as of last year. While Canada's 2015 election didn't see any form of cyber attacks, federal government is attempting to make preventions and heighten its security so as to prevent a cyber attack. So what methods are the federal government implementing? For one, they are going back to the standard paper and pencil, as well as providing greater information in terms of how to spot fake news and the implementation of government safeguards, including BC 50, which is now in the House of Commons, and it proposes to increase fundraising transparency so as to account for all federal party financing. So in the era of fake news, this is one of the pitfalls of technological progression, which is giving up one's privacy. During Global Awareness Week at Bishop's University, we learned from a UN security official that the internet is not free. You pay for it with your privacy. This comes at a time when reports stated millions of Americans' information was provided to Donald Trump's election campaign. This prompted an investigation into the Liberal Party to determine whether Canadians' information was provided to the federal Liberals' election campaign. What's to happen if Canada was to have a cyber attack in the next federal election? For one, there's less trust in the democratic institutions, and secondly, It hinders the democratic right of citizens and obfuscates their votes. So essentially, it hinders the entire purpose of democracy. And this can play to the advantage of foreign hackers because it provides a sense of control into the affairs of other nations. And this is an incentive because Western nations have a lot of power already. The benefit of acquiring said information well ahead of time, ahead of the federal election of 2019, the federal government can prepare as much as it can to prevent a cyber attack from ever occurring. So while a cyber attack is likely in the next federal election, the federal government will anticipate this and reduce the impact. Now for what's new in Parliament. I'm introducing a new segment where I tell you what bills are circulating in Parliament and what progress has been made on these particular bills. As of yesterday, Bill C-373, which is purposed to enact a federal framework on reducing impaired driving, went through its second reading. The bill was brought forward by Doug Aylfson, Member of Parliament for Charleswood, Manitoba. With the increasing use of handheld devices, has initiated a major cause for concern at the federal level. According to Stats Canada, the incidents of impaired driving have been on the decline within the past 30 years. It still remains the leading cause of criminal causes of death in Canada, and drug-impaired driving has increased in the past years. This comes from an Impaired Driving in Canada report from 2015. This issue will especially be of concern not only in consideration of texting and driving, but as well as the legalization of marijuana set to be legalized later this year. This bill goes hand in hand with current driving distractions. Now on to the next bill. There will be a second reading of Bill C-375 this afternoon in the House of Commons. The bill was put forward as a private member's bill sponsored by Member of Parliament Majid Jahari. The bill specifies reformation of the Criminal Code to enable a pre-sentence report to contain information regarding mental disorders of an offender. What this does is consider the mental stability of an offender when it comes down to sentencing. This also trails on the probability of sentencing an offender as not criminally responsible for a crime based on their mental stability. As Aaron O'Toole, a Conservative Member of Parliament, has stated, technically, Canada already does this. It already considers the mental capacity of an individual when it comes down to sentencing. For example, consider the case of Quebec cardiologist Guy Turcotte, found not criminally responsible for murdering his 3-year-old daughter and 5-year-old son. According to the House of Commons webpage, private members' bills are rarely passed, but there is a great amount of support for this bill by members of Parliament to formally put mandatory mental health analysis into criminal proceedings. That is all that I have in regards to information for bills today. I will provide more on my next broadcast. I normally wouldn't provide an update if polls weren't altering as swiftly as they were, but alas, they are. The Conservatives have gained the lead now at 37.9%, basically 38%. The Liberals are now in second at 33.7%. The NDP is edging towards 18%. The Green Party is at 5.9%, so almost 6%, and the Bloc Québécois is up a few percentage points at 3.5%. These polls come from the CBC. Now I want to clarify that the CBC's polls provide a cumulative average of polls that are conducted from at least 13 institutes. I'm not looking at one biased source, but rather what the consensus of what these 13 polls indicate. Despite the national lead being taken by the Conservatives, the Liberals still maintain the lead in Quebec at 36.7%, and the Conservatives and other parties still well behind at 21.1% and lower, respectively. The Bloc has gained some momentum since the last poll results, with a projection of acquiring 3 seats when compared to 0 from the last result. That could change. For those who listened to my last report, if Ouellet loses the vote of confidence and step down as leader, which is likely, a new leader can change the face of this electoral competition. So, all in all the parties increased ahead in the polls except for the Liberals that decreased. So just by examining the seat projections, and of course having learned of Canadian politics through my academic career, there is a shifting support from C to C, so across Canada, starting from BC to Newfoundland. So the trend moves from conservatives in the western and prairie provinces. In Ontario, it's nearly evenly competitive between the Tories and the Liberals. Then in Quebec, it becomes increasingly liberal, and this trend liberal majority continues on into the Atlantic provinces, so hence a shift. Okay, so why are given political ideologies more dominant in some regions than others? To help explain this requires looking at history and at the political culture of each province. So going out west, I'd like to specifically explain the presence of Toryism in Alberta, because it is one of the provinces people automatically associate with conservatism. So to provide a brief history, Alberta joined Confederation in 1905. It is also one of the provinces that has felt Western alienation. And what this essentially means is that the province has felt like it has been left out from decisions made at Canada's center, the capital, Ottawa. This was ever more heightened by the conflict associated with Pierre Elliott Trudeau's NEP, National Energy Program, during the 1980s. Historically, politics in the province has been defined by being run by the majority for a lengthy period of time. And this is what we are seeing today, as Alberta's conservatives have dominated the provincial legislature for a great length of time. Prior to the conservatives assuming power, the Liberals had assumed the majority of the legislature during the first quarter of the 20th century. After the Liberals' reign, it was followed by the United Farmers of Alberta from 1921 to 1930, then the Social Credit from 1935 to 1967, and then the Alberta Conservatives have assumed power from the 1970s to about 2012. At this point, the Conservatives have served the longest in Alberta, which explains why they have a strong presence and are the dominant political ideology in the province to this day. And this also reflects into federal politics. Most recently, however, the NDP had won the provincial election of 2015, which signaled the end of a conservative dynasty in the minds of many. So it's hard to say, would the Tories make a comeback, or is Alberta's history the continuous pattern of shifting authority? All in all, this kind of paints a picture as to why conservatism is pretty strong in the province of Alberta. I'm going to take my examination next to Quebec. Quebec is a bit of a mix-up. Being the largest Canadian province and having 77 elected representatives in the House of Commons, there's a greater competition based on the constituency and the amount of competing parties in federal politics. This is increasingly so with the emergence of the Bloc Québécois in 1991, making greater competition for the established Liberals and Conservatives. The politics of the province has been defined as a school of tropical fish, shifting one party to another, and this was stated by my Canadian politics professor. Quebec is increasingly Liberal-dominated, given that it has been the party in power for the majority of the 20th century. Also, consider the fact that the Liberal Party emerged as a centralist party, representing both French and English interests. What attributes to the party's success? Not only was it one of the first parties to historically emerge, but it has managed to appeal to a wide variety of people across class and social lines, language, and regionality. Additionally, the Liberals had the first ever elected French Prime Minister under the leadership of Wilfrid Laurier in 1896. So from the beginning, we can see that the Liberals had always had an appeal to the French Canadien. So I will talk briefly about the Maritime provinces, as I have yet to conduct more extensive research. So the Maritime provinces are among the poorest provinces in Canada, therefore they look for greater social services. And this is partly why I've attributed the Liberals and the NDP are relatively strong in the Maritimes. So ultimately, what a historical analysis helps to clarify is how political ideologies have survived as long as they have, as well as how they emerge. It is still early to discern what political party will emerge as the next government. A lot could happen between now and October of next year. With candidates in the spotlight, they must be careful where they step, and we'll be watching their every move, and I will be there to provide insight into how the parties are doing relative to their leaders and their stance on policies. That is it for this session of Politics in Action. Until then, take care. I'm Emily at CJMQ 88.9 FM.